ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 21, Text 19. The chapter is called Conversation Between Manu and Kadava. Eka Swayam San Jagata Shishiksaya. Dvitiya Yatman Adiyoga Maya. Vijasyata pasi puna pasisyase. Yato nanabhi bhagavan swashaktipi. Eka svayam san jagata sishikshaya. Vritiya yatman adiyoga maya. Jasya da pasi punaga sisya se. Yato nanabhi bhagavan sa shakti bhi. Eka swayam san jagata shishikshaya. Tritiya yatman adiyoga maya. Shrijasya da pasi puna grasisya se. Yato nanabhi bhagavan sa shakti bhi. Word for word translation. Eka, one. Swayam, yourself. San, being. Jagata, the universe. Shishikshaya, with the desire to create. Avitiyaya, without a second. Atman, in yourself. Adhi, controlling. Yogamayaya, by yogamaya. Shrijasi, you create. Adha, those universes. Pasi, you maintain. Puna, again. Rasisyase, you will wind up. Yata, like. Urnanabhi, a spider. Bhagavan, O Lord. Swashaktibhi, by his own energy. Translation proper by Srila Prabhupada. My dear Lord, you alone create the universe, O Personality of Godhead. Desiring to create the universes, you create them, maintain them, and again wind them up by your own energies, which are under the control of your second energy, called Yoga Maya. Just as a spider creates a cobweb by its own energy, and again winds it up. In this verse, two important words nullify the impersonalist theory that everything is God. Here Kadama says, O Personality of Godhead, you are alone. But you have various energies. The example of the spider is very significant also. The spider is an individual living entity, and by its energy it creates a cobweb and plays on it, and whenever it likes it winds up the cobweb, thus ending the play. When the cobweb is manufactured by the saliva of the spider does not become impersonal. Similarly, the creation and manifestation of the material or spiritual energy does not render the creator impersonal. Here the very prayer suggests that God is sentient and can hear the prayers and fulfill the desires of the devotee. Therefore, he is Sachit Ananda Vigraha, the form of bliss, knowledge, and eternity. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshuramilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhisam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Sram Bhakadamayam Dharata Shakarantikam Panchakalpatrubhishcha kripa sindhubhya eva cha pratitanam bhavnibhyo vaishnavibhyo namo namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shiva Sadi Guru Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, Hare Krishna. We'll continue with the conversation between Manan, Swamiva Manu, particularly, and Kodama Muni, who are conversing about the generations that came from the great sons of Priyavrata and Uttanapad, who were ruling the world, the seven islands, according to the religious principles. Of course, for us in this particular Kali Yuga, as it's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, the present age belongs to Vaivashvata Manu. Swayambhuva Manu was ruling previously. So it is explained how in order to populate the universe, of course, Lord Brahma was instructing different sons to get married and create progeny. Some of them agreed, some of them disagreed. But in this particular section, we're seeing how Kardama Muni, the great sage Kardama Muni, was married to Devahuti, and how the other Prajapatis were married. Ruchi was married to Devahuti's sister, Akuti, and Prasuti was married to Daksha. So all these marriages were meant to create offspring which would populate the universe, of course, following the codes of the Vedas, and having a religious and a life of following prescribed duties and sacrifices, they populated the universe. So it wasn't, it was very common in these ages, whether it was in Satya Yuga or not, that the saintly kings would be very religious in their activities. We understand here that even the sage Kardama Muni had meditated for 60,000 years before entering into the field of procreation, so to speak. So begetting children wasn't just recreation. It's filled with responsibility. So these great sages are showing by sacrifice. They are showing what is required to produce good population. Many times when Srila Prabhupada would speak that the world is not overburdened with population, but it is the quality of the population that is causing difficulty and trouble in this world. So there might be 7 billion persons, and the statistics might say that there are we require 2.5 Earth planets to sustain the current population. And this is because of the uncontrolled material desires that majority of that 7 billion have. So they're thinking, if we create our Sputniks or whatever, we will survey the other planets like the moon, different planets, and we can maybe go and live there. This is one of the ventures of mankind, that we want to go to the other planets so we can go and live there, fulfill more of our material desires, and just like we did the Earth planet, destroy the next planet and then move on to the next one like that, because material desires can never be fulfilled. No matter how many planets we try to conquer or go and live in, the very nature of material desires is that they can never be satisfied. They have to be purified according to religious principles. And this we're seeing with the example of the great sages and their offsprings. So in the traditional sense, or in what has been given in the pages of the Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, we're told how the saintly kings or leaders in society were very much conversant with the Vedic text, the conclusion of the Vedic knowledge, how Krishna is to be known and never to be forgotten. So the kings themselves were saintly. They were not like the current leaders that we have who are literally chasing sense gratification. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is explaining the very nature of those type of leaders, the Raja Rishis, when he says, Ivam Paramparam Praptram Imam Raja Sayavidhu Sakala Neha Mahata Yoga Nasta Parantapa. He speaks about how this knowledge of the living entity and the Supreme Personality of Godhead was being expounded to the citizens by the saintly kings, how they would educate their masses about religious principles, however maintaining the material life but also giving them spiritual knowledge. And this is how the knowledge would get given to the persons. Even in the Vanashram system, you would stabilize your material situation so that you gradually rise and come to the platform, at least of mode of goodness, where you'll be able to hear these subject matters better and adapt them into one's own life. We know that when, yes, the holy name, it is all pure and it is powerful, and anyone can hear the holy name, but whether they are actually hearing the holy name, that is a question. So one example that one devotee once gave me to help me understand why either that some persons are not affected much by the holy name or hearing topics in the Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. And they explained that just as the rainfall is very universal in how it pours down, that the raindrops are not choosing to fall on that square as opposed to this square. The rain will just fall, but whether or not, or on the ground. The question, of course, is how fertile is that ground to receive the blessings of the rainfall? So sometimes the recipient is so much in ignorance that even the holy name is not being appreciated. So sometimes it takes, after long and long association, one actually appreciates the holy name or prasadam. Many times prasadam will do the work. It will enter where the philosophy hasn't really entered or where the holy name hasn't really entered. Prasadam softens the heart. And that we see, my husband was telling me at his workplace, he normally brings them maha sweets. And they're very, very impersonal in how they do things. Everyone stays in their lane, does their thing, talks just for the sake of talking. But he said that he sees that after he has given prasadam, they have softened up a bit. They talk more, they smile more, they converse with him a bit more. So we can see how prasadam is able to soften the heart so that one can at least start talking about different subject matters. So Kadama Muni performed sacrifice for 60,000 years to create high-class offsprings. Now this is something, of course, that will shock persons who are not conversant with the art of producing children. Most of the time, what we read and what we see on the television or the movie screen, there's not much sacrifice when it comes to procreation. It just happens, right? Sometimes it happens in places that are very unclean, hours that are inauspicious, days that are inauspicious, and sometimes it is by accident. And it is because of this sinful action that more sin arises. When children have not been planned, or when precaution has not been followed to produce good quality offsprings, you have things like abortion rights. You have all these groups, pro-life, pro-choice, and this is coming because there isn't any control or regulation of the sexual act. So when one starts performing a sinful activity, there's a whole sequence of further sinful actions that follow suit. So we're not controlling our sex desire, therefore we will make it legal for a person to take life into their own hands and perform an abortion so that they can continue with more unrestricted sense gratification. So that further entangles one into this cycle of repeated birth and death over and over and over again. Because as karma is, we have to live out our bad and good karma. So when we live a life of sinful activities, we are further engrossing ourselves in this complicated web. So regulation and action based on bona fide scriptures or the Vedas, it is very, very important, and it is what saves us from having to stay in this cycle of repeated birth and death. And this is why we may wonder, why are we talking about offsprings? Why are we talking about the marriages of Kadama, Muni, and Devahuti? Why are we hearing about Prasuti and Akuti and how they produce so many offsprings, and oh, they went to this planet and then produced this child? What's the big deal? Why don't we talk about something a bit more juicy and directly Krishna? And we need to understand what it is required to even just be classified as a human being. That a life of a human being means regulation, it means control. Anything that falls short of that actually is animal life in a polished version. So the animals don't have to work hard and pay taxes and do all these things to live a comfortable life. They just do their activities anywhere. Or under the tree, by the sidewalk, it just really doesn't matter. But of course we have a very polished affair, because as human beings we have a certain niche, or we have a certain advantage, that we have an intelligence that will make us understand and help us discriminate between what is right and what is wrong. So we're actually meant to be elevating our consciousness. And when we don't elevate our consciousness with hearing subject matters of a higher nature, then our consciousness keeps sliding down and our consciousness becomes very animalistic. And we perform our activities in a very polished manner. But at the end of the day, it is still unregulated. It is still not really civilized society that we live in. And because of this culture of being, this culture of no regulation, this culture of fulfilling your material desires, it's creating a lot of backlash for an individual. So nowadays it is very, very difficult for young persons to be sober. Being sober is laughed at. When you're 15 or 16, these days it starts from 13. If you're too sober, you're boring. If you're not engrossed in your body, if you're not engrossed in your senses, you'll have a hard time having friends. And the society we live in is pushing and aiding uncontrolled sense gratification. If we take, for example, the what do you call these things? Cosmetic industry, health and cosmetic industry. It thrives on creating an impression within, whether it's man or woman these days, this really doesn't matter, in the mind and the consciousness, that unless you look a certain way externally, you're not good enough as a person. If you don't have this figure, if you don't have this figure, if you don't have this type of hair, if you don't have certain type of lips or arms or any type of extremity, then you're not a man, you're not a woman, you're not beautiful, you're not worth it. These are the times that we live in. So you see this narcissistic behavior of being, narcissism practically means being self-absorbed. Self-absorbed in your false ego, pretty much. You think, I'm this body, I'm going to Botox it as much as I want, I will nip and tuck it, remove all the fat, have everything flat, look like a porcelain doll, Right? It creates false idea of who the self is. So we have corporations and leaders supporting this type of industry, which puts people in ignorance. Because if you think you're this body at the moment, that's ignorance. We are not ultimately this gross body that we see, or the subtle body that we experience. There's more to us than the gross and the subtle body. But if we live in a society, or if we live in societies that are propagating this type of lifestyle, then we shouldn't wonder why there is high rates of suicide, depression, and mental illnesses. Because factually, to keep up with this lifestyle is traumatizing. And if you look, like sometimes when we're conversing with people out there, they tell us what they have to go through. It's shocking. I don't have 2 hours a day to put paint on my face. And you know, I'm not against makeup. I'm not saying no one should ever put kajal on that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I don't have 2 hours in a day to do that. Or all these self-hurting techniques that try to make you feel or look a certain way. It's a waste of time. And it is damaging to young people. It is damaging to the elderly people as well. Now it's not only the young people. As you get older, as soon as people see a wrinkle, a gray hair, or the back goes out, it's, oh, I have to do something. I have to do something artificial to fix it because this body is who I am. So this false identification of the body is something that keeps us in ignorance. And if we are surrounded by such a culture, which is what's happening at the moment, we have to make ourselves very, very spiritually strong to understand, okay, who am I? Amidst all of this craziness of having to look, smell, and be a certain way, who am I actually? Am I just my material body? Am I just black, white, pink, purple? Is that who I am, really, for eternity? And if that question is not yes, then we have to find out who we are, separate from our gross and subtle existence. The gross body is there, yes, and we should be taking care of it so that we can perform more devotional service, definitely. But it is not the ultimate goal of life to have a body with, you know, a waist size of a 9-year-old or whatever it might, whatever suits our fancy these days. So it is very, very important that we hear how living entities used to live on this planet, how they used to live their lives, how they got their satisfaction, how they got their internal happiness, how they got their connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even while being in a material body and even while being in this material world. That is important for us to hear, because if we don't see these examples, then we won't think it's possible. If we don't read about these examples and how Krishna facilitates the living entity's desires, then we won't think it's possible. Then we'll just fall back and just live in the now. Right? This is the latest new agey thing for what millennials are into. Just be in the now, just be yourself and reach for the stars and be in the now. What actually that means, I really don't know what being in the now means, but anyway, a lot of mumbo-jumbo talk about loving the self and the self within, but if you ask what the self is, it's really difficult to get an answer what the self is without having some knowledge. So it's not merely a matter of just playing out fancy words, the self, the being, the real ego. I asked someone the other day, I was at Urban Yoga, and they were telling me, and this is very, very common, many persons are attracted to the, you know, idea of reincarnation. Many persons nowadays, yes, they accept, I don't only live once, I can live on. But what is interesting is that because their consciousness is so shriveled up, it is so contaminated, they would rather become animals than become human beings. So many persons want to be birds and horses. And I was speaking to one guy, he's like, yeah, in my next life, I'd love to be a bird. And I said, really, you want to be a bird? Like, why? Like, so I can be free. I'm like, do you think the birds are free? Fine, they can fly, but before you know it, someone will be poaching you. You know, you will have a tag on your foot, you'll be numbered, you'll be used for some study, you'll be used in the cosmetics industry. Do you think that's free? You'll be in a, you know, you'll be put in some game park where people will just like Google at you and like take photos of you, make you feel so uncomfortable. You want to be a dolphin? You want to be a whale? Right? Very soon the oceans will be overly contaminated. You won't be able to even swim in the water. So many persons are attracted to the idea of being different types of animals. And they find no problem with it because it means freedom. And what is freedom in the material world? How free are we? We think we can actually do whatever we want, but we're actually bound. Karma is binding us. So long as we're acting without following the regulations of Shastra, or even accepting the authority of Shastra, we are bound by our karmic activities. So we're actually not free. We are bound by our senses. Right? The senses control us. You know, before I became a devotee, you know, I had first-hand experience of how the senses control you. You think you can keep it together, then your senses get really stimulated by different types of things that I won't mention. And you lose control. You have no control. And then the next day you remember and you just lament about how foolish you were. How stupid you were to have your sense of sight, hearing, or taste control you so much that you performed actions that are not befitting. So we are controlled by our senses. We are controlled by other persons around us as well. So really, that is not freedom. Real freedom begins when we actually gain control, when we can actually just use our body, gross, subtle, in a controlled, regulated manner without having to rely on any type of stimulus. Right? We practice the yoga system, which begins with Shravanam and Kirtanam, and we're able to understand through Shastra what the senses are meant for and what they're not meant for. And we use our body accordingly. Just like Krishna speaks about the tortoise and how it extends its limbs, and when it's not necessary to use its limbs, it withdraws them. So as a human being or just as a person in this world, if it is necessary, we control, you know, our urges of the tongue, belly, and the genitals, as it is said in the Nectar of Instruction, Vajra Vega, Manasakrodha Vega. We have these urges to talk. You know, we ask questions, we give answers all the time, we converse with others, we like to eat. Everyone has to eat something. Right? So we control what goes in and what comes out, and how it affects this region. So when we have control of, you know, the tongue, the belly and the genitals, you know, you can see that we make the right choices and we're much healthier, we're much happier because we actually have control of our body and senses. But if we don't have that control, we perform actions that are abominable. Whether it's a little bit or this much or that much, sinful action is sinful action. So to read about how the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the sons of Lord Brahma were procreating and performing sacrifices for 60,000 years so that they can produce amazing quality of offsprings, it is very, very inspiring. And these offsprings would pave the way so that the world would be a little bit livable, so that we can try to get out of this world. So it is not that Krishna has created this material world so that we just suffer and nothing else. The material world, yes, it is explained that Mahavishnu gave the sidelong glance and impregnated the living entities into the material womb, into the material universes, so that we can live out our desires. And in the process, curb and rectify ourselves. So Krishna provides opportunities where we can hear, where he speaks transcendental literatures, where he gives his history and shows his reciprocation with different types of devotees and how Krishna is able to elevate different types of living beings to a higher platform, to a spiritual platform, so that they can get out of the material world. And it is explained that after his penance, Kadama Muni had vision of the Lord. The Lord appeared because he was pleased with the sacrifice. Now, we're not living for 60,000 years. We'll try for 100. Majority of people don't even make it to 100. So we have this limited time. So we perform sacrifices to please Krishna. Just like the parent is sacrificing for the child. We do it every day. Those of us who, well, I don't have children. But those of you who are parents, you sacrifice. You wake up every day to go to work. And why are we going to work? Who here is in love with their job? Who just jumps up in the morning and says, I'm going to see my boss and my colleague. This is fantastic. Who jumps up like that? No, it's just like, okay, I have to do this. I'm duty bound. Right? Love has a certain aspect of duty. And I was listening to a lecture the other day. I think it was Radhanath Swami. And he was mentioning how love has a mixture of, you know, it'll give you pleasure and pain. And I thought, what? Isn't love just all rosy and it's just like fantastic? But he says pain in the sense that we sacrifice and we go through experiences not for ourselves but for our dependents so that they can have a different type of life. So that, well, at least for us, it's so that we can maintain our Krishna consciousness. So we have to tolerate going to work, dealing with so many personalities who are not inclined to Krishna. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. It depends on our situation. So we tolerate that uncomfortableness just so that we can maintain our family, maintain the temple, maintain the preaching. We give back in that way, especially as a grihastha. So we perform all these things for a higher purpose. And that's why we're able to wake up every day, just go out there, do what we have to do, and get out. But we're not trying to make this huge splash and be there forever till we're 75, we're still at our desk. Till we're 80, till at 90, we're still on our desk, just trying to make a name for ourselves in this material world. After a few years, people forget you. Once you move from one work to the next, people forget, oh yeah, he was working here. Yeah, I vaguely remember him. Yeah, yeah, moving on. Right. So there is sacrifice that we ourselves, even on a material platform, we can relate to sacrifice. The mother has to care for the kids, bear the children, give birth to the children. It is not an easy task. And the father works hard to maintain the family. Not just for like 1 day, 2 days, 1 year, 2 years, for a considerable amount of time. And so that is sacrifice. Sacrifice for a higher cause. Sacrifice for our Krishna consciousness. So this understanding of sacrifice is something that we can relate to. It is tangible because we do it almost every day. We're sacrificing our time and our energy so that we can maintain our Krishna consciousness, pay our rent where we're staying so that we can live at least comfortably enough, chant our rounds, buy bhoga to offer to Krishna, etc. So that sacrifice is there. And Krishna is pleased by that sacrifice, that duty, that commitment that two people have with each other or those who are living in ashrams, that is very, very attractive to Krishna because it shows that mood of sacrificing for a higher cause. You know, it's not that we sacrifice just it's all about me. Krishna will get $5. I'll put it in the hundi every Sunday. It's Krishna consciousness is not about that. The sacrifice is not only for now, but also for the next life. That we're sacrificing for our future with Krishna. That is the plan. We will go through the hurdles now so that our future is bright in the spiritual world, literally speaking. So the example Srila Prabhupada is giving here is of a spider and its web. Now, normally people misunderstand this, especially from an impersonalist point of view, that the Supreme Personality of Godhead always maintains His individuality. He has many different multifarious energies in which He's conducting the material affairs, even the spiritual affairs. Different agents are there to add sweetness to His pastimes. So it does not nullify Krishna's form. It doesn't decrease Krishna's potency as Bhagavan. Just as it is given here, the spider is there, and from its saliva it makes a web. And it plays on its cobweb, and if it wants to, it can wind it up. So the spider web and the spider are separate. Right? They don't merge into each other. So Krishna has His energies, and He is separate from them. So when persons say, we are it, it is us, we are one, it's very, very confusing. How am I you? Like if I say, well, everything is one, so I am you, you are me, give me your wallet. Because you are me, it belongs to me. Give me your wife, give me your children, give me your car. You are it, it is me, we are one. Logically, it just doesn't make sense. We always are individuals. Even those who aspire for Brahman, those who are jnanis, and they try to meditate on the super soul within, sometimes they want to merge with that Brahman instead of going even higher and realizing who Bhagavan is. They stay in that Brahman effulgence temporarily. It is not an eternal home for them. Even they have to come back down. So, just like the example of the bird flying into the tree, Srila Prabhupada would use this example. The bird might camouflage with the tree, right? Or the chameleon. The chameleon camouflages with anything. But it doesn't mean that the chameleon will become the tree. We are one with the Lord in terms of our spiritual nature, but in quality, in quantity, we are separate. The tree will always remain the tree, and the chameleon will always remain the chameleon, although the chameleon might take to the qualities of the tree in terms of color and appearance, but the two will always remain separate. So Krishna, as Bhagavan, is separate from His other energies, His potencies. There's different energies that are used for certain aspects. Right? He has His Leela, avatars, Purusha avatars, Manvantaras, so many different limbs of His expansion are there. And they're separated expansions of the Lord. Everything, yes, has a source. The source is Krishna. And Krishna engages all these different energies to maintain material creation. But the primary creator is Krishna. All the elements are coming from Krishna. And He employs Lord Brahma to be the secondary creator. But we know that everything else is resting on Krishna. All these energies have been created by Krishna. But He engages Lord Brahma in the service as a secondary creator. So by understanding when Krishna is reciprocating with His devotees using different energies, it is always to elevate the devotee to a state of understanding Krishna's Satchidananda Vigraha. That we are meant to understand Krishna has an eternal form, a blissful form, full of eternity and knowledge at the same time, and that we also have that quality. And that quality becomes aroused more and more when we connect to the to a bona fide process. And for us, it is the process of Krishna consciousness, beginning with hearing and chanting. So when we hear every single subject matter in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is meant to elevate our consciousness. It is not meant to keep us here in the material world. Even hearing the genealogy or the dynasties of the, you know, of the Pandavas or the Sun Dynasty or the Moon Dynasty, in all of these we will hear about Krishna's appearance, different incarnations of Krishna, how they have also appeared. And when we become attracted by these pastimes, attracted by these narrations, we want to hear more and more, and our consciousness becomes cleansed. We will become attracted to hearing these subject matters that will then further explain Krishna and Krishna's devotees. It is not that we just hear about Krishna. Chapter after chapter, we're hearing about Krishna, Krishna's devotees, Krishna's spiritual world, the material world, how Krishna manifests all of that. It is quite amazing to read, actually. It is very, very mind-boggling when we read about creation and just how Krishna does it. How he remains aloof, but at the same time he's very much involved. So it's wonderful to hear, actually. It keeps your thirst or your hunger for Krishna alive. Right? In Ayurveda you always have to have your fire. Right? Sometimes you have too much pitta, too much kapha, you need some fire. When we hear Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita or any narration or bhajan explaining the personality of the Supreme Lord and His devotees, our thirst or our hunger for Krishna increases naturally if we're applying the process properly. Sometimes we're not. If we don't apply the process properly, then it is difficult for us to relish Krishna consciousness. So here we are hearing from Kadama Muni and Manu how the progenitors, the Prajapatis are creating living beings. They are having children to populate the universe with a certain type of consciousness. And with that consciousness, they will be able to connect better to their source and help those that are around them, their dependents, to also connect to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So I'll stop here. And I will ask if there's any comments, questions, or corrections. Sorry, the illusion of the material world is? Well, Yoga Maya is Krishna's spiritual energy. So in the Krishna book, it is also explained how Yoga Maya acts in the spiritual world and also in the material world. In certain instances, Prabhupada will just say Mahamaya. And sometimes, even when referring to the material world, Srila Prabhupada will even explain it to be under the influence of Yoga Maya. So it is that one potency acting differently. So in the spiritual world, Yoga Maya acts, of course, to keep connecting the living entities towards Krishna. But when it gets to the material world, the living entities want to enjoy separately from Krishna. So Yoga Maya creates an illusion. That's why Maya means that which is not, a great energy that creates an illusion, thinking that we are the body, we are our mind, etc. So when it gets tainted with the material energy of time, with the three modes of material nature, it creates a degenerating effect where it creates an effect of diminishing or depleting qualities of the living entity, or keeping them covered. So in the material world, this yoga maya or this mahamaya energy, it keeps us a bit further away from Krishna and a bit further from understanding our true identity. Whereas the opposite is in the spiritual world. It acts to attract the living entities towards Krishna and to create pastimes of ever-increasing bliss between Krishna and the devotees. There's no more questions. Thank you very much. Namaste, Shrimad Bhagavatam.